Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. More confident than United before a Europa League final. Gamble responsibly. See dunluey.net.
Now you're welcome back. Plenty going on and off the pitch when it comes to Irish football. Delighted to say we have former Republic of Ireland manager Brian Kerr with us. Evening, Brian.
Good evening, Joe. How you doing?
Yeah, very well. So it's been a long wait for Stephen Kenny. I'd say he's just thrilled to get stuck into this week and get on the training ground and start actually doing the job.
Yeah, it's been a strange time all round, but having been appointed to the role early in the year and expecting maybe to be playing a match in a few weeks' time back in the March period, I'm sure it's been quite frustrating for him, and also the fact he hasn't been able to go and watch the players live. Obviously, been unable to travel. He would have had to depend on what he was able to see on, whatever scouting system they use for watching games and TV, and his memory of when he was going to watch players to assess them for the 21s. So that's all a little bit awkward, because there's nothing better than going to watch players live and make your own mind up about them, Joe. But look, at last, I'm sure he's delighted to be up and running and out on the training pitch for the last couple of days with the players.
There must be certain points in international management where you're watching tape after tape and performance after performance and player after player, and you're thinking to yourself, Jesus, is any of this of any real benefit past a certain point? You know, am I just waiting for the next get together to come?
Well, usually the live matches would keep you going, Joe. You'd be watching tapes of the opposition more, of the next team you're going to play or the team after that, or maybe two matches down the line. But you're mostly going to see players live in the club matches. But I have no doubt that in this situation, Stephen and Damien Duff and Keith Andrews, I know they have been watching a lot of matches, a lot of tapes. I would say of the last few Irish games, and obviously the teams that we've got to play over the next period of time, the busy period that's to come up with the matches now with Bulgaria and Finland and the Slovakia, the big game with Slovakia, obviously the potential match with the next match in the playoff, whatever it is, whether it's the third place or the playoff. So all those teams, Wales, then have to be assessed also. So I'm sure that's what they've been doing. But I have no doubt that they had frustrations about not being able to go and watch the players live.
So he's had a training session yesterday. They've trained today before flying out, and presumably they'll train at the stadium tomorrow. We have to be realistic here. There's been so much talk about what Stephen Kenny is going to bring to Irish football and the type of football that we might hopefully see down the line. Realistically, working with players at this level, what can you hope to achieve as a manager in probably, 180 minutes on the training ground with them?
Again, I know that Stephen has spoken to the players in this sort of methodology, Zoom calls with players, going back to when he was first installed in the job. I think that was one of the first things he did. He contacted all the players and spoke to them directly. So I'm sure he's already given them a fair picture of how he wants to go about it, of his approach, of the style that he wants to play. And I would imagine that over the long period of time he's probably had repeated phone calls with some of them and discussions with them about the role, and maybe some assessment of how they've been playing when football eventually got going again and the season was finished up. the English league season, the championship season was finished up, that would have allowed them to assess how the players were playing and maybe have further discussions. I don't know for certain that this has happened, but I'd imagine that this is what's happened. And now that they're in they have the group together, he would have, I think I saw reports that he had outlined to them in the meeting of how he wanted to go about it. And then they were out on the training pitch and have had a couple of training sessions. Those sessions are very important. I heard a report yesterday that there were 2 hours on the training pitch. And the time can easily drift away when you have a lot of information to impart in the first training session or two. You might want to stay on longer and get a bit more in and use up the time, you know, to make the best impact possible. Because I know that Stephen was concerned that he was only going to have really 2 good sessions with the players before the game, the first game. At least that's what he thought. I don't know whether it's worked out any better because of the time scale of the matches, where he's actually getting another session in. Probably will get a session in Bulgaria tomorrow, won't he, before the game. So that'd be 3. But you've got to make the best of them. But, you know, all the things you do, Joe, you have to take account that the opposition are doing the same. And they'll have a way of playing and they'll want to impose their way of playing on Ireland. Now, Bulgaria haven't been in very good nick. The game here last year, they were absolutely desperate. It was more or less our second team played in the match, and we won 3-1, and it was a dreadful friendly international, one of the types of friendly internationals that makes us kind of feel some joy about the Nations League format, because that was an awful match. And we covered a match with Virgin when they played England. They were beaten 6-0 on that horrendous night when the black players were abused. And the referee, it seemed like he was going to stop the game a couple of times because of the racial abuse of some of the English players. But as a football team, as an international team, they were very uncompetitive.
They were. It was the night, to jog people's memories, it was the night Jack Byrne came on and made a bit of an impact and at least gave the night a sense of something. But otherwise, it was fairly dire stuff.
In the game here, we got 3 late-ish enough goals and they got a late penalty early after the captain scored. And I think he's gone now. He's changed and the manager's changed, I think, also. But, you know, they want to play in their way and we want to play. And obviously, Stephen has talked about the style. He's talked a lot about how he wants to impose the style. Only thing I'd say, Joe, is, you know, it's as if a lot of the journalists have forgotten about the fact that we did often play a lot of good football over the years. It wouldn't be new for an Irish team to play good football and to try and play on the front foot. Irish teams have always tried to play on the front foot within reason. Mm. In recent years, we may not have had the quality of players. And when the matches started, I don't think Martin O'Neill's intention was to end up sitting back in the games against Wales and Denmark in that group, in that qualification group, when we had very little of the ball. I think his intention, both him and Roy, would have been that we'd have been dominating possession. But we didn't, because the opposition had decent players and they were able to control the game. And, you know, I'm sure Stephen has looked at those games, looked at the Denmark game, the last game with Mick, and where Delaney and Shona, Delaney got hurt early on, Højbjerg came on, and how they dominated the game from there. And I'm sure, you know, the new plan will be to play a lot higher, not allow the centre-backs to get on the ball and control possession in the opposition's half. That the intent will be to close them down and chase them and press them and get control of the game and push up the back four, where what we've had, you know, for the last good while, it'd be Shane Duffy and John Egan. And if we play the third centre-back, sitting back close to our own penalty area, and our midfield sitting back fairly close to them as well, and then the front players in our own half. Stephen's intention will obviously be that'll be the other way. We'll be wanting to be up the pitch and forcing the opposition and getting our defenders, our back four, as I think Stephen will play, a back four, within, you know, 10, 15, 20 yards of the halfway line, and that we'll be playing the other half. That'll be the intention. And I think we can do that against Bulgaria, and we probably should be able to do it against Finland. Finland have qualified for the Euros, Joe. Mm. I think they got 16 goals in the group, finished second to Italy, lost the two matches to Italy. The goals were, Pukki got 10 goals for them. They wouldn't be a great team. They haven't got significant players playing at significant clubs, but they're an effective unit and play on the counter-attack. And it's been remarkable that they've qualified, the first time that they've qualified, helped by the fact that it's 24 teams and all that. They've never qualified before. But I think we'll be on the front foot against Finland as well. Mm. And then you see where that takes you after that. But every team you play won't allow you to hustle and bustle them off the ball. Some of them will play around you and play through you when you try to close them down and try and pressure them in their own half of the pitch, and they'll expose you when they play through. So, you know, I'm sure there's a plan for that. And Stephen was quite pragmatic when he was at Dundalk as well. It wasn't always gung-ho. I can, you know, I have a picture of the match with AZ Alkmaar in Holland, where in the Netherlands, where Dundalk didn't have a huge amount of the ball. When they had the ball, they used it very well. Mm. And then they fell behind in the game, and then they had to go for it late on, and Kieran Kilduff came on and played centre-forward, and Noel Orthodox centre-forward, main man, put a big bloke up the middle, and we knock a ball in the box, and he might get a header on it and score, and he did. Now, so it's not always been, you know, we'll knock her about across the back four, and our centre-half will dribble out over it, and we'll build her up through the middle, and, you know, sometimes it'll be a bit different as well.
If he does go with
there's some ideas, Joe, on how it is in international football. You're playing against often the managers, the opposition. They're usually the best bloke they can get. The players are the best players they can get. They will work and prepare. They'll analyse Ireland. They won't have anything to go on against Stephen, because Stephen hasn't managed a team before. They'll be looking at how Mick set up the team over the last few matches, and they might be preparing on the basis of that. So that's good for Stephen. It gives him a chance to surprise them.
Yeah, but I take your point about the quality of the opposition. You know, often we can analyse ourselves in isolation, and we're not talking about what the other team have done to make our life difficult. Just in terms of, I guess, you know, you're perfectly placed to answer some of these questions, given that you've been there and done it. That first week in charge, or that, you know, first period in charge, what were the big adjustments that you had to make when you became manager? Is it suddenly dealing with, you know, your words being on back pages and headline news? Is it the dealing with calibre of player and kind of the short lead-in time into games? Is it all fairly, you know, okay, and I've done this before, and it's just different bunch of lads, and it's fine? What were your memories of that kind of first meeting or two with the international team?
Well, I had a lot of experience, Joe. I've been doing it with the international teams. I've been with Liam Toohey in the 80s for 5 years with Noel. And then when I got, you know, I'd had various other international squads where I only had short times with the colleges teams. So then I had the underage teams for years. So I knew how it worked. You had 2 or 3 days before it, whether it was a small tournament, a mini tournament, or whether it was going to the finals. Going to a finals tournament, you might have a week, and you use that the best you could. So there was nothing particularly strange about it. For me, the problem was that I was only given the job on, I think, the last day of January in 2003, and we had a match 2 weeks later. I think it was a Tuesday that I was announced officially that I had the job, and 2 weeks later in early February we had a match away to Scotland. So in that space of time, I had to pick a squad, do all the connections with all the players, and even Jason McAtee, our friend, I contacted each individual player and talked to them all and went through a similar process to Stephen. And then we went to Scotland, and I only had the players come in on the Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. So I trained on Monday, Tuesday, and we played on Wednesday night against Scotland. So I had to pack a lot into those training sessions. Was there any different? I mean, there was a big one going on around Roy at that time, around Roy Keane, whether Roy was going to come back or not. And I got a phone call during the final training session on the pitch in Hampden on the Tuesday night, during the training session, to tell me that Roy wasn't coming back, that it was being announced on the main 6 o'clock evening news that night. And this was in the middle of the training session when I was doing some tactical work. So it was a little bit of something extra to go on in my brain. So I continued with the session and I finished up, and then we went into the dressing room. I explained to the players what had happened, and I said, that's it, we walk away now with this as a group. And I got back to the hotel and there was a media scrum. I don't know if you were there, Joe.
No.
Waiting for me when I got in the hotel, in the door of the hotel. So I had to do a stand-up version of a press conference with me back against the pillar in the lobby of the hotel, explaining my view of what had happened and what went on. So that was, that was a kind of an interesting start. But then we played the match. So, but you know what I wanted to do, much like Stephen, you want to let the players understand that you're serious, that you're prepared, that you know the game, that you know, you're not trying to overimpress them with your knowledge, but you're trying to make them feel this fella knows what he's talking about. And then when you get out on the training ground, when you do some tactical, I mean, look, I had Chris Hughton with me, I had Noel O'Reilly with me, and they were brilliant coaches, highly respected. The international players didn't know Noel, but they knew Chris, obviously. And they knew Chris. Some of them were at Spurs. Robbie was at Spurs. Stephen Carr was at Spurs. Gary Doherty was at Spurs. So they, some of them knew Chris very well. But there's also a part where I've got to do the tactical work, and I have images in my head about how I want us to walk the ball out from the back. You know, I was manager, we like to play it out in the back too, and walk it out in the back and through the middle and get the front players involved, and show that, and then also show how Scotland would want to play and how we would deal with that, how we would stop them playing their game, but how could we impose our game? So they're the sort of things you want to do, and you want the players to feel, okay, I know what I have to do, and you want them, you know, you want them to understand, but also to use their own intelligence and make decisions themselves, but give them a format and a bit of clarity about the priorities in different areas of the pitch.
Yes, and you mentioned there the media scrum, and that's a slight difference. So suddenly what you say is going to be on the back pages. When you're the Republic of Ireland manager, what you say is news, and that's a bit of a change. Did that extra attention or that bigger platform take some getting used to, or was it okay?
Yeah, again, it was gradual for me because I've been in the League of Ireland, and, you know, St. Patrick's Athletic, we always had a decent profile, and there was the regular lads who covered the League of Ireland at that time. And then when, you know, I went on to the underage international teams, there was a fair profile on them because we were quite successful, but there wasn't that many people could afford to go to the tournaments we were playing in. You know, there was a limited number of journalists could have went to Malaysia or Nigeria or, you know, Sweden, Norway, Cyprus, even Scotland, Iceland, all the places that we played in our finals over the years. So, but there was a reasonable number, but It was a different level altogether with the senior team. It was a different level because after Jack Charlton's era, there was obviously an increase in the numbers, and it wasn't just the sports journalists or the soccer journalists that were covering the national team. It was the colour writers, the feature writers, everyone was covered in the national team. And that continued through mixed time. And obviously the whole Japan, Saipan incident had brought more attention from anyone. Everyone and anyone was taking notice of what was going on with the national team. So that was, all those people were all sitting around. So it was big. The numbers were big. It was different. It was more intense. There was a lot more of the press conferences, Joe.
Right.
And you know, I would hope that Stephen, that there's better work now in terms of control of that. I think there is. But, you know, certainly I found that they wanted to roll me out every day if I do it.
You're right, okay.
You know? It was almost like, we need you on every day. And there was no consideration of the work we were doing, the amount of work we were doing every day. That I didn't need the bother of it every day. I didn't need the intensity of the scrutiny and discussion. And sometimes it's very hard to explain to journalists, you know, why you would play a certain player above another player, or why you might think that way.
Your
mind is working a different way. Your mind is kind of, it's it's your mind's at times is a little bit like a very small computer assessing loads of things and making your mind up on it. And it can be hard to explain to other people why you come up with that decision in the end.
Well, you might need to protect a player, or there's stuff you have to keep private, and as you said, there is an intensity to the scrutiny which is not there in other positions.
Exactly, and that's, you know, Stephen will have to do that. I found in my time the FA gave me very little. They didn't understand that. They wanted to weigh me out on a daily basis, and I used to say no. I'd say I'm doing so. Say we have, you know, 5 days, 9 days altogether between the build-up days, the first match, the say the 2 or 3 days between the next match, and I'd end up going, right, I know I have to do the after-match one on both days, and I have to do the previous day before the match. That's 4 days. Mm. And I'll do 2 other days. You can pick the other two, but I'm not doing the 9. And that would have became a little bit of a bone of contention. And then getting the players to agree to who appeared was also always a bone of contention. The players never wanted to do a job. Mm. And I would have found that it was often me cajoling players and asking them to do the press conference, because they all, for various reasons, didn't enjoy doing them, because they maybe felt there was some criticism about them before, or they just didn't like doing them. And the people who were asking them in the FAI structure weren't very good at asking them either. So, and there was nothing within the contracts that said they had to do a certain amount. So that was always fraught with a bit. Anyway, Stephen will have it, you know, he'll do it his own way, and but there's a lot more of it, and he'll have to deal with a lot more of it.
Yeah, it's the nature of the job. In about 30 seconds, sorry, we've gone way over time here, is there any team selection on Thursday that you're looking out for in particular, and why?
Well, I think we'll all be looking out for how he handles the Matt Doherty, Seamus Coleman one. I mean, the last match he played, Mick played the Denmark 1-1, it was Matt Doherty, Shane Duffy, John Egan and Stevens, and Seamus Coleman was suspended. So, what would I do? I had my chance, Joe. I don't know. I think Stephen Kenny is entitled to make his own mind up on these things. He's close to the players. He's been watching those tapes closely. He has his own ideas within his own head of how it has to be played. And I wouldn't try to make that decision for him. I think there's room for both of them in the team. Matt Doherty's the foreign player. He scored the goal against Denmark. We know he scored goals. He scored goals for Wolves. He has scored for the last few seasons. And he is the foreign one for the right back position. But Seamus has been a very steady player for us, although his form hasn't been great in a lot of the recent internationals. He seemed to be back in a bit of form for Everton when the restart got going. He played well in the latter part of the season. That's a big one. The midfield, every area of the pitch, a big one. I heard your little debate early on, what Nathan was saying about the training session, and that looked like the three, and the others looked like the three. I thought Stephen was going to play 4-2-3-1, you know, so it sounded like the lads are accepting it's going to be 4-3-3, but I think I would think that James McGarty is going to play. I think Hourihan has a very good chance of playing. I don't know. James McLean was always a favourite of Stephen, you know, going back to his dirty days, so he should play. Who plays centre forward? Would Shane Long get a go ahead of Ida? I don't know. I really wouldn't try to guess them. And he's the one that has had to say, like Jeff Hendrick, Nathan said he's a definite to play, but he hasn't played since March. Mm. Is he a definite to play? I suppose he is, but not on the form he played in when he played. He hasn't played well enough. He's got to play better than that. He's got to play better than he has done. He's been very uninfluential in so many games. Yeah. But in a new high pressure type of game with clear part of the problem has been, obviously, players haven't had clear roles. Clearly defined roles in the team. I think the roles are going to be much more defined and clear now, and maybe some of the players who have underperformed will play better within that. They have to.
Hopefully. Brian Kerr, thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, as obnoxiously passionate about soccer as Frank Lampard after the final whistle. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now, you're welcome along to the Football Show. Much to discuss. To do so, we have Daniel McDonald from the Irish Independent with us. Good evening.
Evening, Joe. How are you?
Very well. Quite a few days.
I mean, it's sort of in keeping with, in keeping with the last couple of months, to be honest. Like, we haven't really, I don't know, like, the Irish football beat hasn't really had a quiet pandemic as such, you know. There's always been something going on between probably the various strands that we might cover across the show today, to be honest, you know, between FAI politics, you know, League of Ireland dramas, Stephen Kenny's imminent takeover, you know, and all of them have probably, you know, come together in one at a crossroads again this week too. So it's a sort of a, you know, it's an on-speed version of stuff that's been happening over the last couple of months, really.
Let's just recap on last night then at Abbottstown and the FAI's EGM. 94% of members voted in favour of the MOU. No surprise, the alternative was doomsday.
Yeah, no, it was. And I think, I suppose I go back to maybe the meeting in the Red Cow, whenever that was. It was a couple of months ago. A couple of weeks ago. And I think maybe around that time, there would have been people he would have spoken to afterwards who maybe still would have spoken as though at that point maybe was a no vote a possibility. It was always something that was sort of lingering in the background. And probably even throughout the summer when the broader discussion had been, you know, just come up, you know, how might that vote go? But I think, you know, there was obviously developments in the last week or so to maybe appease some factions. There was information meetings held in the build-up to this EGM containing pretty much all the people that were going to be in it, just maybe in smaller sections of point. And a lot of questions maybe were dealt with there. Don't want to get madly bogged down in it, but, you know, sort of a key change would have been that people who'd been on the council for 10 years or longer would have to go immediately. Now, they've actually changed the council structure into a more bigger general assembly type thing. But I mean, to summarise it in a sentence, really, people who thought they would have to go now, you know, government sort of offered basically what is a concession to allow those people to stay until 2022. That fended off a lot of opposition, and what I think some reservations linger about aspects of what's been done. I think the vote itself was pretty emphatic. You know, the various votes out of 123, you had like 114 or 116 or thereabouts. And really, I think, you know, people realised that ultimately you had no other option when it came to, I suppose, a deal that is quite, you know, the association's financial history is tied up. But I know Mick Wallace would have strongly pushed a view that there's no way government were going to sort of shut up shop if you had said no. But enough people were convinced that really you just had to say yes to these changes. And as you mentioned, 94% is pretty clear.
I mean, Mick Wallace could well be right, but it would be a hell of a chance to take. And the doomsday they were talking about, that would certainly involve people's jobs, that would involve the international embarrassment for all concerned, and I think it would have even extended to Irish teams being withdrawn from competition.
Yeah, I mean, again, like the extent to which you believe it might have gone that far, I mean, you can definitely debate and question that.
Okay.
And we'll probably talk a bit about optics across this chat to some degree. I just think the optics of it would have been pretty bad as well, that I think, you know, there obviously would be a view out there that when the FAI was handed what was effectively like a, you can dress it up in whatever way you want, but you can call it a rescue deal or a bailout deal, you know, whatever you want to frame it. you know, there would have been possibly a view that at this time, I mean, it's a very delicate year for a lot of reasons. And whilst football obviously has huge benefit as a sport and for what it contributes to society and to communities, at the same time, you know, handing over or committing to hand over a substantial amount of money to the FAI, I can understand why some taxpayers would raise questions about that, you know, given the association's recent history. So as a consequence, I think the members saying no to that, in what really, like, the reason for saying no, I think while there was different people having different reasons for doing so, there is no doubt that the final vote shows that the prevailing concern for a large number of those people was their own positions, no matter what way you look at it.
Yeah.
But I think saying no on that basis would have been a catastrophe, really, in terms of your perception.
Well, even I thought the perception of Mick Wallace saying after the Red Cow meeting, you know, effectively he was saying, look, they'll bail us out here no matter what we do. We're the biggest sport in the country. We're too big to fail. There was almost some kind of cognitive dissonance in his head between what he was saying and the fact he was talking about taxpayers' money and just how it looked. You know, he's publicly saying
to the cameras.
Yeah. He was saying, look, doesn't matter what, we'll get the bailout regardless. You know, we'll get that money regardless from the government because we're such a big sport. You know, the taxpayers amongst us are watching that thinking, that is not really the attitude you want to put on full display.
No, and listen, I'm a huge admirer of Mick Wallace. I mean, he's a genuine, like, you know, genuine sort of bona fides in terms of his, like, football background and so on. You know, I know he gets more publicity because of his political background, but I sort of tend to agree with you. I mean, like, obviously, you know, his club Wexford have had issues in recent years. And again, I find myself talking about, you know, Mick is such a strong voice. It's a shame he wasn't more vocal about FAI matters in recent times. But like, you can't keep saying that about everyone either. I do accept that point. But I think, you know, to promote actively a sort of a let's put it up to the government stance, I think that's probably ill-advised. You know, there was other stuff I think raised in the meeting last night, though. I think there was people raising questions about, say, what assets do the FAI have, and maybe just pushing for a small bit more detail about are these all the cards that we have to play, or do we have a full appraisal of the financial situation here before accepting? And I completely acknowledge, you know, the thinking behind asking pertinent questions. And in reality, the one thing about last night, and several people who were at the meeting did say this to me. I say at the meeting, it was a virtual meeting. And we've all become used to virtual meetings, and they have a purpose, but it's probably harder. It's probably harder to have a flow of debate than you would in a room. The Red Cow won a couple of weeks back. It was they avoided Clifton style controversies, but they did have people in the complex just in two different rooms. It was a smaller gathering of 69 people. There was two rooms and there was a video link. There was no partition or anything like that. But there was a sense that a number of people in a room could get going, and there was a bit of a back and forth if you were in the same room. There was no facility to do that last night, and I think any opposition was sort of stilted by it, if you get me, as well. It probably suited the FAI in the circumstances. But then again, the vote again was pretty clear cut too.
Okay, so in terms of headline news, the vote being passed, that is the most significant aspect of last night, in that 35 million is suddenly freed up and the association avoids insolvency. And it's crazy that we're talking in these terms, but that's where we are. Secondary to that, but not insignificant, Roy Barrett, the chairperson of the FAI currently, was forced to defend himself. It has emerged in recent days, I would think, in the last week or so, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but that Patrick Kennedy, who is the Bank of Ireland chief, recommended Roy Barrett to AMRAP, AMRAP being the headhunters, the recruitment company who were looking for somebody to fill the role of FAI chairperson. And given that the Bank of Ireland were and are the FAI's chief creditors, the question has been asked in various quarters, was this not a serious conflict of interest? Should this not have been declared? How appropriate is it that the Bank of Ireland chief, who will very shortly, I suspect he knew at the time, be having serious discussions with the FAI, was recommending the key person on the opposite side of the table? That's the obvious, you know, point to make here. We'll hear in a moment Roy Barrett defending himself very vigorously, but this seemed to blow up yesterday, Dan, more so than over the previous week or so.
You know, it did. I mean, I suppose you've had someone like Larry Bass, who's been very vocal in bringing it to the fore. I know he was on with OTB AM this morning again. Yeah. He'd been elsewhere, I suppose, on the broadcast circuit as well, speaking about it. And
he's the chairman of Cabin Tealy. I think he's on the new FAI finance committee, which still hasn't met, by the way, but he's on that committee.
Yeah, he was rolled out, I think, for a press conference at some stage in recent memory. I recall him being in Abbottstown on a top table, probably after off the back of the initial governance reforms last year, which I guess the newer FAI power brokers weren't very keen on those reforms. And a lot of this comes back to maybe their opinion of it, but how they've how they've communicated some of their changes. But I mean, that's a bit of a by the by too. The nub of the issue, which did dominate last night, there is no doubt about it. There's Roy Barrett, who initially didn't really do any press at all since he sort of assumed the position of FAI independent chair. I don't think he really has much interest in doing that, and sort of prefers to be more so behind the scenes, but probably has put himself in sort of positions now where he really has to come out and face the cameras. I'm not sure if it's necessarily his natural environment, to be out there front and center. But it is a fact that there have serious questions been raised. I think Gary Owens on your own show last night alluded to the fact that there was contact between Kennedy and Roy Barrett. Around his appointment, that it possibly would have been better if it had come to light earlier. I think that would be a fair enough view. Like Roy Barrett, you're going to play some Roy Barrett, so I'm not going to sort of talk across it. But it's clear that he doesn't believe that this issue should hang over events to the extent that it has. Mm. And I guess there's various opinions around it to some degree. Some born out of just suspicion of Roy Barrett and Gary Owens and Niall Quinn and how they've sort of come into a position of power. And that suspicion has been there throughout it. There is also just a point of view that because the FAI's recent history is so checkered, I find myself falling into it naturally. I'm even saying there, Mick Wallace, well, why wasn't he speaking before? And some of these people, why weren't they speaking before? But just because people weren't speaking before, it doesn't mean that when they raise issues now, that that should be thrown at everyone who does. And we should welcome the fact that there's an open debate and there's open scrutiny of everything that's been done. And I think Roy Barrett, even at one point, I think last night, said that he doesn't mind criticism. And that's the way that it should be going forward. It just seems to be that in their attempts to move one step forward, they can't get beyond issues probably that could have been wrapped up. Shouldn't be coming to light in the last week, that they possibly should have come to light beforehand. But that, there's that. But on the other hand, there's an element of, well, how seriously do we treat this matter? There's an element of, I think Roy Barrett calls some stuff conspiracy theories. That was a phrase that he used. And I think, there's possibly some element of that too. But the failure to disclose stuff earlier leaves yourself open to that, because people just hear the FAI brand now. And I think they're naturally suspicious. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're struggling to move beyond any presentation of a newer FAI.
Well, here, Roy Barrett, now here he is talking to Nathan last night. This is the section in particular on the Patrick Kennedy, Bank of Ireland chief, recommendation to AMRAP.
I understand there were several questions about your appointment and the role of sure. Patrick Kennedy within that from Bank of Ireland.
Yeah.
When did you first speak to Patrick Kennedy about this job?
I only spoke to Patrick once when I was approached by AMRAP. And I spoke with AMRAP. They told me that a number of people had recommended me, including Patrick. I talked to Patrick after that meeting for about 2 or 3 minutes, and that's what it was. So I think quite a lot has been made of it, and there's a bit of a conspiracy theory around it, but there's nothing untoward in my view, and certainly in terms of my dealing with Bank of Ireland or any other stakeholders. Did it represent any form of conflict whatsoever? No, it didn't.
Did you not think at any stage when you're having that very short conversation with him that
I had the
him being the head of the main banker for a debt-ridden organisation may well be a conflict, even viewed as a conflict from the outside.
Sure. But you have to remember, when I had that conversation, I had only just been approached, and what I did, having met AMREP in the first time, was said I would think about the role, and in thinking of it, I wanted to meet a number of people, including people from the FAI, from the accountants, Grant Thornton, from the department, for the ministers, just from Sport Ireland, from you know, Mr. Horan, who did the governance reforms, to acquaint myself with all of the issues and make a decision as to whether I thought I could help the organisation or not. So in terms of did I think that meeting in any way compromised me, not at all, actually.
There's a lot of talk this week of a new era, both on and off the pitch. But do you think this story casts something of a shadow over that, that the transparency that people would expect from the new FAI maybe isn't quite there?
But it's completely transparent. Like it's completely transparent. You know, AMREP approached me on the basis of a number of recommendations, one of whom we now know, and it's as simple as that. It's actually quite normal way of doing business, and so I don't think it should cast a shadow. Certainly, in my own mind, it doesn't cast any shadow, and I suppose that's my view.
To what extent it casts a shadow, I'm not sure. It's certainly a talking point. Dan, I'm torn on this. I don't quite know how serious all this is as I think about it. Gary Owens was on the show yesterday. I certainly asked the appropriate questions, especially in light of the association's history. He acknowledged there maybe was a conflict and it should have been declared earlier. Roy Barrett says they are being completely transparent. Like, he's explained what happened and he's arguing he wasn't compromised. So I accept that to a point. Maybe it's belated, but there is a transparency to it. Certainly, I mean, why AMROP are seeking the advice of the Bank of Ireland on this appointment is questionable. Like, they should be going nowhere near the Bank of Ireland, I would put it to you, just for optics reasons, if nothing else. Regardless of who Patrick Kennedy was to recommend, say he recommends you and you get the job, just the fact that Bank of Ireland have had any sway, influence, minute or otherwise, in this appointment doesn't sit right with me, and I suspect doesn't sit right with the general footballing fraternity. The FAI's chief creditor should not be in any capacity consulted over this appointment. It just makes for obvious reasons. You know, I'm amazed that they were. That said, the extent to which Roy Barrett was compromised based on a brief conversation with Patrick Kennedy, I'm not so sure it's massive. I think it's just a hiccup, and the current leadership need to be beyond reproach. They need to be whiter than white. They can't have any sense of old establishment Ireland, Oireachtas Golf Committees. Well, I know him, he knows me, our sons go to school together in the private school down the road, so not in a wink. You know, however business has been done in this country over however many decades, that can't be part of the FAI situation going forward. I'm inclined to think, on the balance of everything, it was a little misguided that Bank of Ireland had any say in the appointment. I don't think that Roy Barrett is compromised to any significant degree here. He certainly doesn't think so. So give me your opinion. Is this very, very serious? Am I brushing by this a bit too quickly?
Yeah, I am conscious of coming across a bit fatigued by it, because then that sort of, you know, that shouldn't be a complacency that exists, even if it might be true. And I think it possibly reflects how a lot, you know, I'm only getting a small number of sort of people, sort of punters, really reacting to this in any way. What's frustrating about it and what's vexing about it, I think, for a lot of people, is that these are, you know, communications that did or didn't happen in December and January, and we're now talking about them in September. You know, and why is it taking us this? Like, we're there in September last night. No, we're in September, sorry, August last night, but we're at this point in the road. We're having like these big inquisitions about, well, you know, who said who to what, you know, and when, and like we're 9 months later, and you would think that if
Gary
if
Owens the community said last night, we just didn't think, you know,
yeah,
what did we want? Did we want a press release? I mean, realistically, would we have expected a press release?
Okay, but I think that the problem they have with that is that that's tied in with the whole perception around in January, when Roy Barrett again was the only person in doing the rescue deal talks, and there was no footballer elected directors in it. But there is almost a sense that they've come in and they have taken over. This is a perception, they've taken over and they're not communicating with the football elected people, and that's it. So it's almost like, you know, well, we're in and you're over there, but we don't need to, you know, we don't need to deal with you. You know, that's almost the how it's been portrayed, I think. And there's no doubt that that communication is poor. Now, it's strange, you know, around January when the new people come in, I would have been chatting to some people around that time, and they would have been very impressed by the extent to which Roy Barrett had taken control of the situation initially. But in hindsight now, there's a sense of, well, actually, you know, there should have been proper... You know, there should have been a proper way of which certain issues have been flagged and raised. And there is an element of this that I do think I've seen people, was it Kieran Cunningham or a few people like tweeting about this is official Ireland at work about it. And, you know, there probably is a sense of that, you know, there's a certain level of people who've operated at a level of society are very all familiar with each other. They all know each other a long time. They probably encounter and speak to each other regularly enough. But now, of course, you have to deem how appropriate all these discussions were. And that is, you know, when you have an image problem, all this stuff coming up 8 to 9 months later is an issue. Now, throughout, as I said, throughout the last 8-9 months as well, or maybe the last 4 or 5 months, like there has been a sort of a wing of people who've been very strong and very critical of, say, the Barrett, Owens, Quinn axis, if you want to sort of phrase the visionary group as they once were a member of. And it would be sort of from the Larry Bass school, the Andrew Doyle at Shell school, probably Gary Kelleher at St. Pat's, sort of League of Ireland officials who are definitely like not old FAI guard as such. You know, they're not from the Delaneyite here or anything like that. And they've certainly been persistent throughout. And of course, you have to look at everyone and think, well, what's their angle here? You know, what's, are they unhappy? You know, there's certainly a view that exists that there would have been quite a number of officials within the League of Ireland who maybe would be strongly of the opinion that a breakaway is what needs to happen. And I think, you know, a couple of these people would be in that line of thought. And what's their angle on that? You know, because there seems to be a strong resistance towards that within the FAI, the people that have come in. So there's just friction and reason, you know, and factors and personalities there. And you're looking at what's actually happening here. But really, a lot of it comes down to, on one hand, if everything is perfectly transparent and everything is above board, then why was it communicated so badly? And that only fueled suspicion that it wasn't.
Okay.
The issue. So yeah. I feel we're getting into this sort of like vortex of just going round in a circle on it. A lot of people are like, yeah. I think what happens from here is, more to the point, like Larry Bass, even this morning, as someone who's quite critical, was asked, I think, by Jer several times, you know, have you lost confidence in Roy Barrett? And he said, you know, he reserved his position on that. I do think there's an element now of, I'm not saying you just accept it. I don't think you should. I think the board are going to have issues with it. I think the questions keep coming up. But I think at heart, what happens here, what's happened is that Roy Barrett and his people as such don't think the reforms that were introduced last year were good enough. And they want to introduce their way of doing business now. I think they probably are going to get a bit of time to do that. And a lot of people are going to be watching them very closely. Rather than necessarily having a honeymoon period, it's more, we're on you from the start here. So everything they do going forward is going to be scrutinized extremely closely. And that's probably how it should be anyway.
Okay. So to boil it down, I know there are various stakeholders with various opinions in all of this. You, as a, I would like to say, relatively honest broker in all this, how serious do you think this issue is then?
I think it's serious, but my personal opinion is that I don't think it's an issue whereby people go, you know, and I think you have to sort of, you have to take the explanation on board. Learn from it, you know, it sounds sort of a trite sort of comment, but just, it's certainly like it's got, you know, worthy attention, and it should be sort of something that is flagged as an issue of concern. I guess what I'm balancing it against to some degree is, you know, like, if you speak of, compare it to the old FBI, I think Roy Barrett is a lower profile figure. I've heard from people in UEFA who are still probably looking with a bit of amusement at this, but I think he's got off on a reasonable footing there. They do seem to have a reasonable relationship with government, far better than what was there before, really, in terms of constructively getting stuff. You know, the state funding has now been doubled. So I think there is, I think there's a sense of that you don't just sort of dismiss it, but I think there's a sense of, right, well, you know, there's a strike against you from this point, but what can you actually do? Can you, if you have a better plan and you have relationships and you can bring things forward, then good. But you have to bring these other people with you. They have they're changing these committee structures, so they don't think they were fit for purpose, the ones that were there. There was issues. I mean, it's bad that some of these committees weren't set up, but the early anecdotal tales about some of these committees were also terrible, it must be said, you know, in terms of how people were maneuvering around to get on it. To get on them. So, you know, what they've put in place now is a sort of an electoral code and a structure that we'll see how it fares and how it performs. But I think, look, what was voted through last night is that there's 6 independent directors on the board going forward. Let's see what caliber of additional people come in and give this time. But it's been scarring. There's no doubt about that, but I don't think it should be fatal. One that we sort of, you know, it should be fatal. No.
Okay. So
no, that's my opinion. That's just my opinion. Others will disagree.
No, but
even Harry Bass
who cares?
This morning didn't necessarily come down on that.
I just wanted
you know?
Your opinion. I just wanted your opinion because, I mean, one thing which we are not short of in this story is opinion and people briefing and phone calls. And, behind the scenes in there, you've got one cohort looking across the hallway, another cohort looking across the room, and another cohort, and it's not a happy family behind the scenes, that is for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of angles. I'd be looking at everyone's angle.
Yeah,
everyone's
angle. It's hard to know where the honest brokers are in the midst of it all. So, okay, we'll call it a hiccup and not a good look and a strike and whatever euphemism you want to use, but maybe not a fatal situation, which, you know, we're not counting down the days to this group having to exit on the back of it. Let's take a short ad break, and then I do want to talk to you about matters on the field and your piece on Dundalk as well, which garnered huge attention over the weekend. So back in 1 second with Daniel McDonald.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. A more electric team up than Salah and Mane. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Now welcome back. Dan McDonald from the Irish Independent still here. Stephen Kenny starting 11. Go.
Oh, God, I'm actually going to have to do this for, we always do in the paper on match day, we sort of do a graphic where you put in a predicted 11 or a probable 11. And I've been thinking about it. So I reserve my right to change it between now and Thursday. Obviously Randolph, obviously Stevens, Duffy, Egan. Maybe Doherty, I think. Yeah, I know. I think it was Kenny Cunningham saying that. I think it's possible. I think Matt Doherty. I'd be very surprised if Matt Doherty didn't play, and I'd be very surprised if Stephen Kenny played him in a different position. So I guess I am coming around to Doherty as a rightful ahead of Coleman. The one niggling thought I have in my head, and like, is that I wonder with these two games, and Stephen Kenny's not a massive rotation sort of manager. He's not been one to do that, really, you know, particularly defensively. You know, I don't think he'd be up for changing it, but I wonder, is Bulgaria in some ways being viewed as more of a prep for Slovakia, you know, than maybe the home game against Finland on Sunday? So that's maybe why I'm thinking that it may not be 100% attack as you might sort of expect it to be, because he is far more pragmatic than I think people imagine. He will be bold, but there will be thinking behind it too, and I'm sure the personalities of his coaches will overlap with his thoughts. So anyway, that's probably I think if James McCarthy is fit, he plays. I think Jeff Hendricks certainly plays. So you know, you're talking, it could well be the retention of McCarthy, and then so the retention of Hendrick and Conor Hourihan around McCarthy, you know, with McCarthy in the middle of sort of that midfield three, and then front three, it'll be Adam Ida or Shane Long as the 9. Probably, I wonder, would he gamble again? I'm trying to think, would he be more a bit, you know, would he gamble on the young lad for the home game? But maybe he might try Ida away with James McLean left and And on the right, maybe Callum Robinson. I think Callum O'Dowd is in with a chance. And I think Aaron Connolly, he just might pick Connolly in the home game. That's just a feeling that I potentially have. There was a press conference he gave a while back. I can't even remember which one it was, where he was speaking about Aaron Connolly. And like he definitely would have a view that when Aaron Connolly plays on the left of the front three, that he shouldn't, like he won't have the defensive responsibility. He actually said you wouldn't expect him to be getting back and behind your fullback as in defensively like you would James McLean. And I think that on that left-sided position, I think it's going to be McLean or Connolly. And, you know, the nature of the opposition, how their fullbacks operate maybe might dictate the choice from game to game. So that's how I think, I'm wondering for the away game, might it be McLean? McLean, either Robinson maybe, but it could just as equally be Connolly, Long and O'Dowd or something, you know. I think it's open enough, and that's the interest that we have options to debate.
Okay. You've obviously been a close observer of Stephen Kenny for a long time. I'm curious, Dan, now that we're seeing him here in game week, he seems to have got off to a very assured start, but just by dint of human nature, we might all be slightly different if we were speaking to the League of Ireland journals that we see every Friday night in terms of our openness and how relaxed we are, as opposed to if we were sitting at the head of a table and the national newspapers are all there and what we say is going to be big news. We might all adjust slightly. Are you seeing a different Stephen Kenny to the one you might have seen at under 21 level or League of Ireland level?
Well, I mean, I think the League of Ireland journalists are the national newspaper journalists, really. So that's not, there hasn't been a dramatic difference so far in terms of that, in terms of the profile of people that he's encountering.
I'm more assuming when he's looking at the group in front of him, he knows that what he's going to say is pretty much nailed on to the back pages of the national newspapers, and if it's explosive enough, front pages. You know, as opposed to if he's talking after Dundalk have won their fifth game in a row and it's another, you know, 3-0
win. I get that, yeah. I know, I get that. But I just think, like, honestly, like, some people are thinking too much about that side of it, you know. I did a piece ages back that I said that I'm not actually disagreeing with your point really, but it's more like, you know, that Stephen Kenny's been hired to be Stephen Kenny. I keep making this point. And there was stuff like the people behind the scenes in the FAI were like worried about his communication and all this sort of stuff, like, you know,
put it this way, he doesn't do a two-page spread with Paul Kimmage if he's still the Dundalk manager. You know, there's a difference. I mean, if the short answer is, I'm not trying to look for some angle here on Stephen Kenny. I'm genuinely just curious if you're seeing the guy just as relaxed as ever and comfortable as ever, and he's seeing the same faces, or if he's a bit more closed and giving a bit less away. That's literally it.
No, I guess there's no evidence that he's gone through a communications clinic tutorial, you know, and that's good.
No, 100%, yeah.
And like, as I made the point, like that, you mentioned that Paul Kimmage piece, for example. I think it's not so much Stephen Kenny that will change and be the issue. I think the issue might be how people who don't know him will interpret his movements. And those who've covered Kenny for a long time are very well aware of what are basically eccentricities at time in terms of how he can handle media stuff publicly. And I think when everyone is watching it, and they might at times see what, you know, a softly spoken answer or a long pause or a silence, and it might be interpreted as, oh, he's feeling the pressure with this scenario here. I would make the point that, you know, and in the most relaxed environment of all time, you know, a 5-0 win against Cove Ramblers or something, you could get the same pause and stare at times when you least expect it. Like, for all that people talk about the media are very well disposed towards Stephen Kenny, there's never actually been like a chumminess in the relationship. I think maybe back in the day, Brian Kerr would have been very close to, say, members of the media through the underage days and stuff like that. But like Stephen Kenny, like there's a huge swell of goodwill towards him. But he's always, to my mind anyway, like, you know, he's always known when to keep a certain distance. And yeah, okay, you can speak to him and he can call, like, you know, to do, you know, when you're a League of Ireland manager, you can call someone for team news. It's obviously very different when it's, you know, it's international. But he's never been someone that's been that type of matey type character, if you get me, you know. So I think he's always carried himself in a slightly different way to most others. And I think those who covered the beat for a long time will spot and recognize that, and will notice. But it's more how actually, God, I'm almost saying you guys, you know, but I'm saying like sort of the all of a sudden the presenters who have to digest his every word very naturally. It's how they interpret some of that is going to be more of a talking point, because you know at times he may seem hurt and sort of taken aback by something when that he just has a different way of interacting. But he's been very positive like this week, very assertive. I think he's taken he's answering questions in the same way that if you ask him, I think Nathan might have said this the last couple of days, like if you ask a football question, you'll get a football answer. And I think people will find that refreshing if things are going well, that's for sure.
So that's Thursday, and we'll obviously be talking about that game and the Finland game in depth. Before we go, your piece in Dundalk has garnered a huge amount of attention. There's a lot in it, clearly. So really, to sum it up, and you can take it where you want to take it, Peak Six have been owners now for 3 years, and increasingly Bill Hulsizer, who's the...
Hulsizer, I believe, is Hulsizer, the official...
Right. He's the father of Matt, the co-founder of Peak Six. So increasingly, he's been a presence at the club. And he was appointed chairman in December 2019, you point out in your piece. And initially, you might look at his presence increasingly at the club and the interest of Peak Six as a good sign, as opposed to absentee owners who don't give a damn how anything goes. They're hands-on and committed and interested. But it would seem, especially of late, that there is, well, rancor behind the scenes, discomfort. They're not overly impressed, various players or people who've been part of the management team, with what Peak Six are bringing to the party here. Like, for instance, Vinnie Perth, before he left, had to fend off the suggestion that a phone is installed in the dugout so that they could, you know, phone in instructions from America, thoughts from America, or, you know, why doesn't the goalkeeper take corners because he's the best striker of a football kind of, you know, stuff being thrown at him. So what's going on here? This sounds like what looked like a really good arrangement is turning very sour.
Yeah, this is something that's been bubbling for a while. And like the origins of the piece last week really is that probably, you know, there's been murmurs over the last couple of weeks and months, but they've sort of grown louder as time went on. I think lockdown actually played a big part in accelerating things. You know, we almost go back to Stephen Kenny. I mean, Peak Six, you know, again, like they're a sort of a very successful private equity firm who actually do well. They, you know, previously, you know, they were quite resilient in the recession about a decade ago. You know, they the people involved, and even now, like the company is trading, you know, extremely strongly, I'm told by all accounts. And you know, some of the, you know, there any losses they have on Dundalk, I was told by someone pretty well connected, you know, that could be half a day's shares on one of their one of their better buys. So I mean, it's not, there's you know, they're obviously thriving in their own way. What's basically happened here? Like, yeah, Peak Six took over the club on account when Stephen Kenny was there off the back of the European success. And over the last sort of, say, 2 years or so, Peak Six would have had, you know, they would have hired various CEOs. They would have had employees of Peak Six who would have been, you know, over and back on the ground doing their stuff in Ireland. I would have been on European trips last year. There would have been Americans on the flight with the team. You know, they're very much keeping an eye on things, on data, you know, and becoming more and more involved. But what's happened over the last year is like a gradual stripping away of that. And this very bizarre scenario where this quite high profile investment in an Irish sense has gone, like all the various buffers that were there between the owners and the, say, the club in Ireland, a lot of them have steadily left and departed for various reasons. And we've ended up in a situation where the father of Peak Six's founder, Bill Hulsizer, who is not a Peak Six employee, he's not Peak Six, he's been appointed by Peak Six to be the chairman of Dundalk, but actually is a family connection rather than being, say, a Peak Six person, has become more and more involved in the day-to-day affairs of the club. Now, he was around last year. He wanted them to boycott the FAI Cup final over a suspension issue. But at the time, there was people around and there was more a sense of, well, he's really involved. He's very enthusiastic. A lot of the observations about Gary Rogers, the goalkeeper, should take corners. And you know, why don't you have a special code word that you all charge, for, you know, out of nowhere, you know, for a couple of minutes, because when they conceded the last minute goal in the cup final, they all went up from this restart and scored. And he was wondering, why don't you do that in general play? A lot of that stuff was more innocent cultural differences stuff, people just asking questions out of interest. But when all of those buffers start to leave and you have a situation in 2020 where all of a sudden this person is now the main point of contact for people within the club to discuss transfers, to get stuff approved, signed off, it's become more of a problem and it's become more pronounced. And as a result now, the suggestions that were sort of a bit wacky before are now part of like day-to-day policy discussions. And that is how the club has basically started to go off the rails. People there feel somewhat helpless because before they would have had intermediaries there that they could go to, whereas now I just think there's this comfort around, well, this is the father of the owner of the company who pays all the bills. And it's just become awkward and it wore down people that were there. It was a big factor in the end of Vinnie Parrott's days. There's a whole debate around maybe should he have been stronger initially in terms of you know, laying down the ground rules. I think that's a valid talking point. But either way, we've got to a scenario where it's just gone absolutely silly. And it's caused massive upheaval. And more to the point, whatever about the managerial stuff, people who are volunteers on the ground, people who've poured their heart and soul into the club, have been integral figures of the success under Stephen Kenny, you know, and building the club up from nothing. They've all started to walk away gradually because they just can't handle it anymore. All the distractions, all the queries, some of the stuff, you know, I've touched on the piece around individual games, you know, they nearly ended up playing like under 19s in an important league match because they were hung up on playing a friendly against Celtic for prestige reasons. And like, the Dock probably aren't going to win the league now. And that has implications for them going forward. And there's no doubt that distractions around what was going on off the pitch has contributed to that. So it's just really hasn't gone very well.
No, it hasn't. Like, even you mentioned Josh Gatt, his signing was in part on account of an interview he gave to ESPN, which Bill Hulsizer saw like the cut of his jib. And even Josh Gatt himself admits that Hulsizer was the driver of that deal. And that's no way to sign a player, clearly. The overall sense I got from the piece was that there is a degree of self-destruction going on right now, that a lot of the best people are leaving or being asked to leave, and there's no end in sight. You know, you didn't speculate in the piece as to where this goes. Peak Six look like they're sticking around, like they're going to stay, that they're invested. But I mean, if this is the beginning of Dundalk going into decline, then will they be as keen to stick around for, you know, Dundalk finishing eighth in the league and not bringing in much income and not giving them much joy? Like, where does this go is almost the question.
You see, this is the problem, that initially when the father, like when it, like people assumed initially that it's almost like, you know, you've been taken over by a company with a billionaire founder and you just assume that they would never be engaged in Dundalk at all. It would be some underling that would be dealing with that. But when you have all of a sudden a parent, a beloved family member involved, it's brought it way closer. And initially that was interpreted as something that was, well, this is great. But they're very invested in this. I mean, they have been invested in it. Like before the lockdown, but the family were over all the time of the main people involved.
It's worth stating, actually, to be fair to them, and you pointed out in your piece, Dundalk players were paid right through lockdown.
Yes, like they were fully paid. Maybe that's a cultural difference. Maybe if they knew the league more, they'd have stopped turning off the tap like others would have, you know? So like they know, and this is the thing, like money is not really a problem here, but that's now turning into being a bit of an issue because, you know, how long are they going to keep going with it? Like the interpretation is that it's just become a plaything for someone rather than an investment. And like, that's a problem. You asked me, where does it go? A lot of people who spoke to me for the piece wouldn't normally be up for sort of helping journalists, really. They were almost hoping, I think, that probably a lot of this was known probably locally around Dundalk, but not on a national scale. There's probably a hope that this can help to, like, you know, expose awareness of this, that this will almost be a tipping point, as if to say, you know, can someone just shout stop here? And what I've been told, even across the last week, that people, I think that there has been communicated sort of directly to people in, you know, in authority to say, listen, do you understand the damage that this is doing on the ground here? Are you not paying attention to this? And there's a hope that the best case scenario hope really is that this causes a reevaluation, that they now have appointed their new managers who they wanted, even though, you know, they were plucked out of, you know, coaching youth football in America, and there's massive question marks about it. But that maybe in some respects there might be more of a hands-off phase now, because they maybe they just wanted the control of changing management and putting their people in there and so on. So maybe things might breathe, you know, for a while. Mm. But it's hard to be overly encouraged by it unless they really, like, if they actually appoint professional people with a football background to activate their football policy. Because as it stands now, it's just completely unorthodox. And things may calm now, but if you've had the tendency in the past to try and, you know, your management and staff taking phone calls during games or coming off the games and getting voicemails and stuff, that's just no way. That catches up with you eventually. So maybe this flashpoint and this coming to the fore, you know, might expose, maybe people are just talking more about what's been happening and it causes a reevaluation. That's the best case. The worst case, maybe in a way, is that people just get soured by all the criticism. They say, well, if you don't want us here, fine. But like, both of those scenarios have issues with them, really, you know, and it shouldn't have got to this point. Like, the irony is, like, Dundalk actually have got reasonably good draws in the Europa League. Like, honestly, it shouldn't be that complicated a fix, but it almost feels like it's become very, very complicated there because of personality issues. And I don't know how you solve those issues if those personality issues linger.
Okay. Dan McDonald, Irish Independent. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thanks, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. As obnoxiously passionate about soccer as Frank Lampard after the final whistle. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.